Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, your grateful host. We got a great program for you today. Second hour, Jimmy will be here. And we're going to do weird questions with Jimmy Akin. Always a great way to spend a Friday afternoon. Maybe it's Friday evening where you are. Maybe even a Saturday morning, depending on where you're listening. Wherever it is, we're glad you're here. First hour, Dr. John Bergsma is with us, who has written beautiful books on the Bible and a very fine book. Actually, you probably have heard me mention it a lot of times because whenever this comes up, I always mention how good Dr. John Bergsma's book on the Dead Sea Scrolls is. So we're going to talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls today. If you got questions about first century Judaism, the Judaism of the time of Jesus or the time just before Jesus, you got a question about how that Judaism was lived out, how Jesus related to it, all of that. More than welcome. Maybe you got a specific question about the Dead Sea Scrolls. I mean, if you're going to do one of those in scroll number 37B, then you're going to definitely be above my head, but we'll give it a try. The number is 888-318-7884. And I said I'm your grateful host and because for two reasons. One, I'm only giving out one number today, and it's I am not good at multitasking. As you have probably noticed, not my strong suit. So today the number will just be 888-318-7884. No fundraising phone number. And also grateful because of all the generosity of folks who really helped us out. And it was pretty clear, I think, during the 3 days of our fundraising that it was a bit of a struggle this time, which sometimes it is. And the heartening thing at those times is that there's folks that'll just pick up the phone and call and, you know, maybe they weren't even going to give this time, but they're like, well, they need it. And lots of folks did that and came through for us. I have no idea what the final number will be. We really can't know that until after the weekend because Darren is just very slow at math. So we'll once he gets his pencil sharpened, we'll figure it out and we'll tell you how it all went. I'm sure that it will be less than the ideal, but we'll muddle through and we'll figure it all out. So again, thank you for the generosity. I know many people prayed for us. They told us that as well. Lots of people called and just said lovely things and lots of people. You know, we say we struggled, but the other side of that is lots of people picked up that phone or went on the website and gave to support this apostolate so that we could continue our work, which we think is valuable because we think people knowing Jesus is valuable, and there's nothing that changes a life for the better, ours, yours, anybody else's, than knowing Jesus. So thank you again for your support. Our guest this hour, Dr. John Bergsma, is a full professor of theology at Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio, which I'm guessing is probably under 9 or 12 feet of snow right now. Dr. Bergsma used to be a Protestant pastor for 4 years. He served as a Protestant pastor. He went to Notre Dame University to get his PhD, and he became Catholic in 2001. He's the author of a bunch of books, but let me list a few of them. A Catholic Introduction to the Bible, the Old Testament, Jesus and the Old Testament Roots of the Priesthood, and the one I mentioned before, Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, Revealing the Jewish Roots of Christianity. Dr. John Bergsma, thank you for being with us.
Absolutely, Sky. Always a good time to be with you. And you're right, we're under a lot of snow here.
Yeah, and it was blowing too. That's what I saw. So good luck digging out.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
Yeah, you really sound like you appreciate that. The number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I may have used this idea before when I've talked to you about these things. First of all, I do talk about your book, Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, a lot because I loved it. It was like just the most exciting, like little glimpse into a world, the world that Jesus lived in. And it really is exciting. But it makes me think this, that in some ways we are so far from the society that Jesus lived in, you know, thousands of years, generation after generation. But in some ways we're nearer now to Jesus than the people 1,000 years ago were because they didn't have the Dead Sea Scrolls. They didn't have, you know, these things. The Dead Sea Scrolls really do get us closer to Jesus.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a providential find. You know, we can almost see the hand of God in it because right in the middle of the 20th century, when in some ways criticism of the New Testament and criticism of the historical Jesus was at its height with figures like Rudolf Bultmann, who just said that all the gospels were fictitious and the only thing we could know about Jesus was that he died. Right while that is going on in scholarship, we discover this library of a Jewish monastery that was flourishing at the time of Jesus. And we recover documents that were literally written pen on paper while St. Paul was alive, while our Lord was alive, while the apostles were exercising their ministry and doing their thing in the land of Israel. And we find in the scrolls phrases that otherwise are only found in the Gospel of John, for example, or the epistles of Paul, and not in other classical documents and so on. So we find the context for certain theological terms and certain theological phrases. And that's such a wonderful evidence that the Gospels and the epistles of Paul are authentic to that time period that they claim to be from the first century, from the life of the Lord, pre-70 Israel. You know, 70 is the big date because that's when the temple was destroyed, and that was the end of an era. But this is clearly pre-70 Judaism, and we can compare it very favorably with the documents of the New Testament, giving us a lot of confidence in the historicity and the authenticity of these documents.
If you'd like to talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Judaism of Jesus' time, 888-318-7884. Dr. John Bergsma, our guest, 888-318-7884. Things in the Bible that otherwise are very odd suddenly become kind of clear. At least they see. I got that sense, yes, in your book when you see them in the light of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I mean, John the Baptist went out at 4 or 5 years old and lived in the desert till the time Jesus came. That doesn't actually make a lot of sense, but it does in the light of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah. So Luke 1:80 says that he was out in the desert. We're talking about John the Baptist, of course, out in the desert until he begins his public ministry. And, you know, we're so used to it, Cy, you know, those of us that have grown up in the faith, and you just think, well, that's what John the Baptist does. He grows up in the desert. So we don't sit down and think, you know, what would that involve? And how would an adolescent or a child survive out in the Judean desert? Well, here we read in the Jewish historian Josephus that these monks out on the Dead Sea, out on the shores of the Dead Sea, would take in boys from the larger community and raise them in the monastery and form them according to their manners. And it's very interesting. Josephus actually uses the term form, just like we do in the Catholic Church today, to talk about formation, you know, spiritual formation, human formation, and so on. So they formed these young men, and that's how they got many of their vocations. We can imagine that was probably orphans or, you know, people sent their sons out there because this was a center of learning. They had a library of about 1,000 volumes. That's just mind-blowing for the day. This is an enormous center of learning. And so if you want your son to become a theologian, you want him to be a great priest, you want him to know the religion of Israel very well, you know, you send him out to get educated by the monks. And this makes sense of what otherwise is just this throwaway line, is like, why would Elizabeth and Zachariah send this little kid out into the desert, you know, to fend for himself and eat bugs and stuff? And no, that's not what's going on. He's going out and being raised by the monks.
888-318-7884, the number. Dr. John Bergsma, our guest. We're talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Whether you're Christian or not, whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call with your question if you have a question about those early years, those years when Jesus himself walked, and the years even before that, the formative years for the Judaism of Jesus' time. Your call, your question is very welcome here. 888-318-7884. So we know the Sadducees. We know something about the Sadducees. They come across very grumpy, frankly, in the New Testament. We know, yes, about the Pharisees. They come across as a mixed bag, the Pharisees. But neither of them are the people that gave us the Dead Sea Scrolls.
That's right. Yeah, the Sadducees were grumpy because they didn't believe in an afterlife. and that can make you bummed out.
Yeah. Okay?
They didn't believe in heaven, and so they were sad, you see. Oh, I'm sure you've heard that one before. Yeah.
Wah, like, wah, wah. Wah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay. All right. Sorry about that. I couldn't resist. Anyway, oldest preacher joke there is. So the Sadducees did not believe in an afterlife, did not believe in angels or spirits. They only accepted the five books of Moses. That'll make you kind of grumpy if that's all your Bible consists
of. Yeah, right. It's a lot of rules.
Especially a lot of rules, and Moses is in a bad mood at the end and at the end of Deuteronomy. But that's the Sadducees. They controlled the temple. They were the chief priests. Pharisees were a scholarly movement, very uptight, trying to get everybody to live by these high standards of purity. We know of them because they're in the Gospels. Actually, the third group is in the Gospels as well. It's just that they're not called Essenes in the Gospels. But as well, I'm sure we'll get to later, we can see them at certain places in the Gospels if we know what to look for, the kind of manner and dress and custom and stuff like that. We can identify some Essenes. But Essenes, the name Essene was an outsider term. What they called themselves was Israel, or the repentant of Israel, or the many of Israel. And that's interesting because that phrase shows up at the Last Supper when Jesus says, this cup is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. That that was a little term that the many was similar idea to the church, and we can talk about that as well. But these Essenes were about the same size as the Pharisee movement, but they kept to themselves. They lived by super high standards of purity. They were waiting for the Messiah to come back at any time. They studied and prayed intensely. They lived poverty. They engaged in charitable works and works of mercy, and they also practiced celibacy and monasticism. So a lot of those features are similar to the early church, not all, and there's some very important differences between them and the gospel and the church, but a lot of similarities too. And so it's really fascinating, and we got a ton of information about them from the historian Josephus. He writes pages and pages about their habits and manners and beliefs.
He's very impressed with them.
He is. He was a Pharisee, but he writes more about the Essenes, like three or four times more about the Essenes than he does about his own movement, the Pharisees. He was just like fascinated. Couldn't get enough of these guys. And then we got the remains of their library, so they can see what they think about themselves, and we can also see what outsiders thought about them.
Again, the number 888-318-7884. I would just keep talking to Dr. Bergsma all day, but there are folks on the line, and we will go to the phones. We've got to take a very quick break, and then we'll head back to the phone, or we'll head to the phones to talk to take questions on the Dead Sea Scrolls and that Judaism of the time of Christ right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Wherever you are in the world, you can access the EWTN Global Catholic Network. It's everywhere. You can get EWTN's great Catholic programming on your car radio, at home on your TV, computer, or smart speaker. With EWTN's app, you can take EWTN everywhere, on your phone or mobile device. If you want your news in print, turn to EWTN's paper of record, the National Catholic Register. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host. Our guest is Dr. John Bergsma. And I think people who listen know that I love all the things like Josephus, who was mentioned, and the writers like Ignatius and Polycarp that give us a window into early Christianity. Well, the works that Dr. John Bergsma is here to talk about with us, the works of that are found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, are not Christian works, they're Jewish works, but they give us an unbelievable insight, view into the world that Jesus lived in. And if you have questions about them, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I got some more questions about the Essenes, but I want to get to the phone. So how about we do that, and I'll come back with my questions about the Essenes.
Absolutely.
All right, let's go to Ethan in Cincinnati, Ohio, watching on YouTube. Ethan, you're very welcome here. Go ahead with your question for Dr. John Bergsma.
God bless you, too.
Well, thank you.
Dr. John Bergsma, I really love your book, Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's one of the few books I've read that have made my jaw drop when reading it. You know what I mean?
This guy gets it. I had the same reaction. I love that book.
Yeah.
My question for you is, whenever the Essenes are brought up, a lot of people will refute whenever like this stuff about the Essenes is brought, they'll refute it by saying, well, oh, they were just a fringe cult that didn't really represent Judaism. What would you say about that?
I would say that's just historically not the case. Read Josephus. He's the first century historian. He was a Pharisee himself. He had no reason to exaggerate the influence of the Essenes, but he was fascinated with them and wrote pages and pages about them. He says that they were one of the three main schools of thought in Judaism. And he tells us that every town in Israel had a community of Essenes living in it. So this was no negligible group that can just be shunted to the side. Moreover, we've got archaeological record. We've got the remains of a monastery, a complex of buildings down on the shores of the Dead Sea that could house between 100 and 200 men. We know it was inhabited for about 200 years, and their library consisted of over 1,000 very well-written religious texts, including the oldest copy of a biblical book that we have in our possession. And you know, a library of 1,000 scrolls in first century Judaism, that is a major center of learning. They were a force to be contended with in the first century in the Jewish context. Josephus talks about the influence of some of their leaders and their prophets. A general from the Essene group was part of the military staff that fought against the Romans in that final battle. So again, this is not a fringe group. This is a very important branch of Judaism.
What do you think, Ethan?
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Very good. All right. Well, pick your jaw up, Ethan. Appreciate that call. The number is 888-318-7884. I'm going back to calls, but let me just lay this one on you real quick. Was John the Baptist show the signs that he was an Essene himself?
He's not an Essene. Well, he's preaching, because the theology of his preaching, as recorded in the Gospels, is different than Essene theology, but has many striking similarities with it. My view, and I argue this in my book, was that he was raised in the community, and that explains a lot of the similarities that he has with the Essenes, but was either left or was kicked out and branched off on his own. So he has important differences with them, as well as important similarities.
Again, Ethan, thanks. We're talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Dr. John Bergsma is our guest. We go now to Aurora, Illinois. Mark, listening on 97.5 FM. You are very welcome. Mark, go ahead with your question.
Yes, thank you. I've often speculated jokingly that the reason the Bible doesn't tell us much about Jesus' childhood is that God wanted the Freudians to keep their hands off.
Well, that's certainly a positive side effect. Whether that was the intention, that's a good side effect.
Well, the historian Paul Johnson has guessed that a lot of the content of his parables reflects jobs, you might say, that Jesus did before he entered into public ministry. So the shepherd parables, for example, or the parables about architecture. And I just wonder, do the Dead Sea Scrolls tell us anything about Jesus' childhood and early manhood that we hadn't known directly from the texts themselves?
Yeah. Nothing explicit. They do give us a picture of the beliefs and expectations of Jews in the time of our Lord. So, for example, the sermon at Nazareth that we see that Jesus begins his ministry with in Luke 4, that is really, really interesting because Isaiah 61, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because it anointed me to preach good news to the poor, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. That's what Jesus reads there in Nazareth. And that text was associated by the Essenes with the return of Melchizedek, the priest king, from Genesis 14. They believed he was going to return someday and proclaim a year of Jubilee that would free people from the power of Satan and from the debt of their sin. Because, of course, the Jubilee year freed you from slavery and freed you from your debts. But this is going to be a spiritual Jubilee. And so it's just fascinating that Jesus, as a young man beginning his public ministry at, say, age 30, chooses that text to announce in his hometown. And Nazareth looks like it was a sympathetic town to the Essenes because archaeologically we can determine that they practiced farming in an Essene manner. That was discovered only about 2 years ago. We could talk about that if you want later, how they found that out. But Nazareth looks like it was sympathetic to the Essene movement. And so when Jesus announces Isaiah 61, he is, and that it's fulfilled, he is suggesting that he is this Melchizedek, this priest king that they were expecting. And then he backs it up by casting a demon out of a man later in that same chapter. That's freeing people from the slavery to Satan. And then the following chapter, he forgives a man's sins when they lower that paralytic down out of the ceiling in front of him. So he's doing the things that the Essenes expected the end times Melchizedek to do. And that's part of the reason why the word about him just spread like wildfire. And we keep reading in the Gospels about how everybody was going out from all the towns to go out to see him, because this guy was doing what they were expected, what they were expecting, you know, these famous supernatural characters and prophecies to actually deliver on.
What do you think, Mark?
I find all of this very fascinating. I might add that I assume that Paul Johnson, the historian, was a Christian because he talks in this little biography of Jesus about how he learned the Bible at his mother's knee and how he attended Sunday school as a boy. And he would tend to support the notion that Jesus was a stonemason because of the parable imagery about the cornerstone and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, yes. And that's interesting with the Essene movement. When we look at the archaeology of Qumran, they are very skillful. They didn't put a lot of effort into making their quarters very elegant. But when we see that when they wanted to do something well, like make an aqueduct or a ritual bath, they were very expert stonemasons and plasterers and extremely skillful. So it's an interesting kind of connection there.
Mark, thanks very, very much for the call. We're talking with Dr. John Bergsma. Among his books is Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I think our last caller, Mark, captures it. It is exciting because, you know, you think about Jesus and his preaching. And I remember even thinking as a child, like, well, how did he even get started? Like, he didn't. And you know, you think about these guys who get up on the street corner and preach, and everyone just ignores them. But Jesus is actually answering immediate expectations of the community. And we see this in the Dead Sea Scrolls. The community is expecting certain things. The things he does perfectly match those, sometimes by perfectly, I mean, they're also, he's modifying them, but he's showing them who he is. And so it's immediate. They recognize who he is in the things he does.
Yes, absolutely. And to have documents that confirm these expectations, and you see this kind of like hand and glove fit between Luke and the expectations expressed in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which we know were copied in the first century. And you got to say, hey, the gospel really fits the lifetime of Jesus.
888-318-7884. Hey, callers, hang on the line. I really am going to get as many of you on as I can. It's such an exciting topic. We have this new, by new, I mean, just, you know, in the last century, this look into the world of Jesus. Your call's welcome. 888-318-7884.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Tomorrow on Mortal Life, the life you were meant to live.
We'll look at how the theology of the body can help you live a more abundant life.
That's tomorrow on Mortal Life, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 Central on EWTN Radio.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our number is 888-318-7884. Second hour, we'll do weird questions with Jimmy Akin. That's always fun. And this hour, we're talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls, one of my favorite things to talk about because I love John Bergsma's book, Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. You can get it wherever good Catholic books are sold. You can probably get it where bad Catholic books are sold as well. But it's a good one. It's an antidote to all those other bad Catholic books. You'll love it. It's just a fun, exciting read. But if you want to just talk to Dr. Bergsma, you're welcome. 888-318-7884. Scott from Texas called, and he just asked, he said, could you just tell us what are the Dead Sea Scrolls? So maybe we went a little quick there at the beginning. I get excited about this topic, and maybe you could just tell us what the Dead Sea Scrolls are.
Sure. So there's this intense religious movement among Jews, starting maybe in the middle of the 200s BC, where they're breaking off and started to pray together and seriously prepare for the coming of the Messiah. And this group becomes a movement, a religio political party that is called the Essenes. And we know of them from the ancient Jewish historian who goes by the name Josephus, who was a contemporary of St. Paul, and describes them. So anyway, one of the things they did was establish what we would think of as a monastery on the shores of the Dead Sea, perhaps around 150 BC, and that monastery was inhabited right up until the time Jerusalem was destroyed around the year 70 AD. And during that time period, at all times, between 100 to 200 celibate men, monks, okay, lived at this community, and they prayed and they studied the scriptures and worked and did the kind of things that monks typically do in other religions. And they collected a library of over 1,000 scrolls. And either for whatever reason, they stored that library in the caves that surrounded their community, perhaps to protect them because maybe they feared that the Roman soldiers were coming. And their community was wiped out by the Romans, but they left us this library hidden up in those caves, all these scrolls in jars. There, like I said, the remains of over 1,000 scrolls were found. A quarter of those were Old Testament books. Three quarters of them were religious writings of every kind that you would expect to find in a monastic library. So you got commentaries on scripture. You've got prophecies. You've got lectionaries. You've got liturgical calendars. You've got discussions of canon law, you know, all these kinds of things in this library, all reflecting the practice of this first century Jewish group.
Scott, I'm glad you called and asked because it was great to take a minute to do that. Just in reference to the biblical books there, my understanding is that the book of Isaiah is complete and that it is by maybe 800 or 1,000 years the oldest copy of the book of Isaiah. Am I in the ballpark on that?
Yes. Yes. One of the first scrolls that was found is what we call the Great Isaiah Scroll. And it's a complete copy of the book of Isaiah in nearly perfect preservation, at least when it was found. It's aged a bit since because it's gotten exposed to oxygen. But it was in a perfect state of preservation, dating perhaps back as far as 250 BC, at least by the carbon dating of the leather. And this is older by about a millennium than any complete copy of a book of the Old Testament in the original language that we had previously. Previously, we only were back as far as maybe the 900s AD in terms of a complete Hebrew copy of an Old Testament book. And here, with this discovery, it was in 1947 that some Bedouin shepherds stumbled into these caves. With that discovery, we jump back a millennium in terms of our witness to the biblical text. And especially important apologetically, because this places our copies of these Old Testament books before the rise of Islam. And of course, we know that one of the critiques of Christianity that comes from Islam is the idea that Jews and Christians have contaminated or altered the text of Scripture. Well, these are pre-Islamic texts of the Old Testament in the original language, and they testify to the fidelity of the copying of the Bible over the centuries, because there are not significant differences in these copies over against the copy we had before, which only went back to the medieval period.
So preserved as the book of Isaiah, more than 1,000 year span between the two copies, and virtually the same book. I mean, with the kind of errors you would expect, that someone just wrote this wrong or something. But yeah.
Yeah, a wrong letter, a switched word, things like that occasionally. But yeah, but very much, you know, absolutely recognizable as the complete book of Isaiah.
Bill in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, watching on YouTube, you're next. Bill, go ahead with your question for Dr. John Bergsma.
Yeah, hey, Si.
Hi, Bill.
Thanks for taking my call. Also Boston College grad, and I'm still Catholic. So
me too. We did it. We got through, and we're still Catholic. Dr. Bergsma went to Notre Dame, and he became Catholic.
So the
Holy War.
I got to say, I had good Catholic professors there, and I'm grateful to them. I joke about it, but I'm very grateful to the teachers who helped me with my faith.
That's great.
I actually had a class with Peter Kreeft there when I was there. So
yeah.
He is from the same Dutch Calvinist background that I am, and he converted 50 years, almost to the year before I did, but from the same college, same alma mater, same Dutch Calvinist background as Peter Kreeft.
Well, we need more Dutch Calvinists then, because I only know two of them, and you guys are great Catholics.
Yeah, we make great Catholics when you convert.
Bill, I'm sorry, we're chatting, but go ahead with your question.
No worries. So my question was, so Paul converted maybe in 35 AD, who knows? And Dr. John, you said Josephus was a contemporary of Paul. Is there, and then there was a 14-year gap where Paul, after his conversion, kind of went away and prayed. Is there a chance that he was part of the Essenes?
Yeah, that's interesting. I do not think he was part of the Essenes, but it is interesting that there are some phrases from St. Paul that are not found in other ancient literature except in the Dead Sea Scrolls. For example, the phrase works of the law, which is a very important phrase theologically in Romans and Galatians, because St. Paul says we're not saved by works of the law. We actually find that same phrase in a scroll that scholars call On the Works of the Law. It's usually called actually 4QMMT, which is a Hebrew acronym and a bit of jargon to identify the scroll. But it's basically a letter that discusses ritual laws of Judaism, and it refers to these ritual laws as works of the law. And also that same document from the Dead Sea Scrolls uses the phrase reckoned as righteousness, which, of course, is very significant in Paul's argument in the book of Romans, where he talks about Abraham being reckoned as righteous because of his faith. And this document, by the way, happens to be a letter discussing the proper observation of Jewish rituals that the Essenes at Qumran, at their monastery, wrote and sent up to the Pharisees up in Jerusalem to try to persuade the Pharisees to come over to their way of doing things, their way of interpreting Moses's rituals. And so Paul, being a Pharisee, probably read this letter at some point. It was kind of like high-level ecumenical dialogue between the two movements. And so we see that Paul's language really reflects first century Judaism and the concepts that were going around. And I would say that, the Dead Sea Scrolls really verify what Thomas Aquinas had always proposed about understanding Paul, because Paul says that we're not saved by works of the law. But then in Romans 2, Paul says it's the doers of the law who will be justified. And so how do you reconcile that apparent contradiction? And Aquinas said, hey, works of the law refers to ritual laws, but just the law generally is the law, the love of God and love of neighbor. And so that's why Paul treats those two different ideas differently. And then in the Dead Sea Scrolls, sure enough, we find works of the law being used as a term for ceremonial, ritual observances, and not for moral laws or, the Ten Commandments and so on. And so it kind of verifies what Augustine's intuition, I'm sorry, what Aquinas' intuition was back then. But Paul was a Pharisee. I think he had discussions with the Essenes, but did not join that movement.
Okay, Bill?
Yeah, no, that's perfect. Thank you. I'm just trying to, figure out what Paul did for 14 years.
Yeah. He prayed.
Yeah. Not a lot of childhood stories in the New Testament. Well, I shouldn't say childhood in that case, but thank you very much, Bill. I appreciate the call and the question and the shout out to Boston College. But I love Bill's question, because it opens up just another reason why this is such exciting stuff, that you have these phrases in the New Testament that appear nowhere else in the ancient world, and then these documents from out of the ancient Judaism appear among us, in this century, that use the same words and phrases. It puts the whole Christian, well, first of all, it helps us in like, as you said, apologetically, to say, look, these New Testament documents are quite reliable. These reflect what the way that Jewish people spoke at that time and the way they thought. But also, it just gives us a sense of this vital community of expectation for the Messiah that was all over the Jewish world and that Jesus did actually fulfill.
Yeah, absolutely. They were waiting for him. They, you know, another thing, Cy, is we see in the Dead Sea Scrolls that another expectation was that they were going to get both a royal Messiah and a priestly Messiah when the time of fulfillment would come. And if you look at how the Gospel of St. Luke is written, you know, Luke does not begin with the Annunciation and the birth of Jesus. It begins with the Annunciation and birth of John the Baptist. And it's very clear from Luke 2 that John has this very good priestly lineage through his father Zechariah. And so I think what St. Luke is doing, among many things, I mean, he's writing to a broad audience in many different demographics, but one of the things I think St. Luke is doing is for those that were looking for a priestly Messiah, he really holds up to you John the Baptist from the line of Levi, from the sons of Aaron, from the sons of Zadok, who is this extremely holy, ascetical priest prophet who is amply qualified to pass the baton on to the royal Messiah, who is Jesus of Nazareth. And of course, we get his royal genealogy there in Luke 3. So it just, you know, that's tremendous to me because it shows that Luke is writing for his contemporaries and showing that Jesus answers their expectations.
888-318-7884, the number if you want to talk to with Dr. John Bergsma about the Dead Sea Scrolls. I'll recommend the book again, Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Before we go to a break, and we'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back. Joseph in Lincoln, Nebraska, you'll be first up when we come back, and then we'll get to the other callers. The early church was the Catholic Church. If you're a convert, then chances are it was a study of the early church that started you on your way. The hands down, the best book on the early church can be gotten right now for as little as $3 a copy because they've got it in bulk sales now. The early church was the Catholic Church. Get it for your parish. Get it for your group. Distribution for just $3 a copy. Visit Bulk Books at shop.catholic.com and order your bulk copies of the early church was the Catholic Church.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. And you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He was a Jesuit, a cardinal, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Robert Bellarmine is honored for his immense contributions to theology, including helping to draft two important catechisms that defended church teachings during the Protestant Revolt. Pope Clement VIII named Bellarmine a cardinal because, as the Pope put it, Bellarmine had not his equal for learning.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Having just a great Friday. I hope you are as well. Maybe it's Saturday morning where you are. If you're on the other side of the dateline, hope you're having a very nice Saturday morning. Our guest is Dr. John Bergsma. The book is Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. We're talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls. The number, if you want to participate, 888-318-7884. But Dr. Bergsma, unless you have an objection, I'm going to do what I said I'm going to do, was going to do and go to Joseph in Lincoln, Nebraska. I'm taking no objection. Okay, Joseph in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening, of course, on Spirit Catholic Radio. Please go ahead with your question for Dr. Bergsma.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. In light of the Dead Sea Scroll finding, I'm interested in your viewpoint on textual variant types found at Qumran and your viewpoint on Jesus and the apostles choosing the Septuagintal text type, like majority of the time. And I'm not talking about like Greek writings, but Hebrew writings that are in line with the Septuagint.
Right. Yeah, that's a great question and a very technical one too. The reason why we have the Septuagint translation typically being quoted in the documents of the New Testament is, of course, because the apostles and the apostolic men who wrote the New Testament were writing for the broadest audience possible, which was a Greek-speaking audience, and Greek was the international language of its day, just like English is today. I mean, if you go to the land of Israel today, you can make it through most places by speaking English, because most people speak a second language. If you're down bathing in the Dead Sea on the beach and you've got Russians and Chinese and Filipinos and American tourists, the common language is English, you know, and it was Greek back in the first century. So the widely known Greek translation of the Old Testament that was already centuries old and very revered is what typically the apostles and the other authors of the New Testament quote from when they are showing that Jesus fulfills the Bible, fulfills the expectations of the Old Testament prophets. Now, as far as Qumran and the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Septuagint, the fact of the matter is that about 5% of the Old Testament books that we discovered among the Dead Sea Scrolls actually follow the variations that you find in that ancient Greek translation known as the Septuagint, which was begun about the year 250 BC. And that revolutionized Old Testament scholarship. Why? Because for a long time, it had been believed that the differences between the Greek translation of the Old Testament used in ancient times and the Hebrew that we had was the result of bad translation. And suddenly we discovered, no, it was not bad translation. The Greek translators did a good job. They just had different Hebrew texts in front of them. And so what that shows us is that the books of the Bible circulated in ancient times, sometimes in longer and shorter editions, just like books in English do today, kind of longer and shorter editions of, say, Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And sometimes the longer edition is preserved in the Hebrew tradition, and sometimes the longer tradition is preserved in the Greek tradition, but there was some variation. But the Greek translators were responsible. The differences actually go back to the underlying Hebrew, and that is very interesting indeed.
Joseph, thanks very, very much. I appreciate you waiting so that we could get to you. We're talking with Dr. John Bergsma. We're talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls. If you've got questions about the light the Dead Sea Scrolls shed on Jesus and his ministry, on John the Baptist, on the apostles, on the early Christian church, or on the first century in general, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Going to Arizona now. Scott, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You are up next, Scott. Go ahead with your question for Dr. John Bergsma.
Hi, thank you for taking
it. Happy to.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Hi, can you hear me okay?
We can just fine. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, good. I had recently come across a gospel reading in the last couple of weeks in reference, I think it was Mark 4, I think, in reference to Jesus talking about the parables and how some of the parables, you know, he explained and to his disciples, and things were not hidden, and then some things were hidden so that some would not be converted. And at first I'm like, whoa, like Jesus didn't want some people converted? And I know he came for all. So I had to ask a priest, you know, what he thought of that. And he had said that Jesus basically was fulfilling a prophecy in somewhere in Isaiah that spoke about, you know, that there may be, I'm not sure if it does speak. I'm just trying to find out if it is in Isaiah where Jesus was referencing there will be some that don't hear and some that don't see in order for the prophecies to be fulfilled that he would be condemned to death and crucified. So I didn't know if you can help me with that connection or if there is a connection to somewhere in the book of Isaiah.
Okay. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dr. Bergsma.
Yeah, no, that's an awesome question. And it's absolutely right. Yeah, what we're referring to is Isaiah 6. This is Isaiah's call vision. And God asks, who shall I send? Isaiah steps forward, so to speak. He's taken up in a vision in the heavenly court of God. And Isaiah says, here I am, send me. And God commissions him and says, go and make the heart of this people dull, make their ears heavy and blind their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and turn and be healed. And that is Isaiah 6, verse 10. And what this is a kind of a divine reverse psychology, because there's a lot of irony and paradox about this. Isaiah says, he's saying that God sent me to go and make your guys' eyes blind and make your ears deaf so that you don't hear God's word. But he's telling them that that's what he was said to do. And he's writing this down as his prophetic book, and he's publishing it so that all the Jews can read this, the Judeans can read this. And so they read, oh, you know, did you know that Isaiah was sent to make us blind and deaf so that we won't listen to him? You know, so it's meant to kind of arouse a reaction. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's why you were sent. OK, well, I'm going to listen to you just to spite you.
That's funny.
It's that kind of thing. And so it's not really that God intends that people don't listen. Of course, there are going to be people nonetheless who won't. But it's kind of a very provocative way of communicating that around, you know, that catches your attention and maybe even makes you a little bit angry, but it certainly forces you to think about what's going on here. And of course, Jesus and the prophets as well, you know, all the prophets communicate in very provocative ways that are designed to arouse emotion and grab attention. Certainly Ezekiel does in his book. I mean, look at Ezekiel 16 or 20 or Ezekiel 23. It's R-rated stuff. You know, it's like, whoa, this is in the Bible? And it's like, wow, yeah, this is to wake people up to the message. And our Lord, too, said very provocative things like, if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. And if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. This was completely in keeping with this aggressive way of grabbing the attention of the listeners that was part of the prophetic tradition. And yes, that reference to Isaiah 6 is made. The passage I'm most familiar with is in Matthew 13, but it also occurs in the parallel of Matthew 13 in Mark, because, of course, Mark and Matthew have many parallel passages, of course.
Hey, thanks very much. I appreciate that call. I hope that was helpful to you, Scott. It certainly was helpful to us here. That's fascinating stuff to talk about. I tell you what, Dr. Bergsma, I love your writing. I love the way you write. And I tell everybody all the time, whenever they ask me about Dead Sea Scrolls or any of that, I say, you should read Dr. John Bergsma's book, The Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. So I asked you, and I only got 30 seconds for you to answer this, if John the Baptist wasn't a scene, what about people who say Jesus wasn't a scene?
Yeah, there's no strong evidence for that, but there is strong evidence that he spent part of the last week of his life before his death and resurrection with the Essene community. Because when he goes into Jerusalem, he sends Peter and John to find a guy carrying a jar of water. That was women's work. Typically, the only guys that carried water jars didn't have women in their community. So that guy was probably celibate. Only Essenes practiced celibacy. Probably an Essene that led them back to the upper room.
Ah, fascinating stuff. We could probably do a show just on the garments of linen when you talk about the Essenes and their linen garments. So we'll do that another time. Dr. John Bergsma, author of Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, thank you so much. A wonderful hour.
Yeah. Thank you, Si. It's been great to be on with you.
All right. God bless you and stay healthy while you're digging out. You know, take a break every now and then, digging out of that snow. Jimmy Akin coming up. We're going to do weird questions with Jimmy Akin. That's always fun. We'll be right back to do that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.